The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
We're grateful to have you as a listener, and we want to learn more about your listening habits and how we can serve you better. We have a survey running right now and would love to hear from you. It shouldn't take much more than 5 minutes to complete. Go to washingtonpost.com/podcastsurvey. That's washingtonpost.com/podcastsurvey. When you're done, you can enter a sweepstakes to win a $100 gift card. We really appreciate your help. Thanks so much.
You're listening to Washington Post Live's First Look podcast with Jonathan Capehart.
Welcome to First Look, Washington Post Live's one-stop shop for news and analysis. I'm Jonathan Capehart, associate editor at the Washington Post. It might be Friday, but the results of Tuesday's primaries and ballot initiatives, especially what happened in Kansas, continue to reverberate. Plus, we've got big jobs numbers and everything on the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022. So joining me now to discuss all of that, Amber Phillips, politics reporter at the Washington Post. Amber, welcome back to First Look.
Hey, Jonathan.
So we got to cram in a lot of stuff, but let's start with the big news that's just out. Huge job creation numbers, 528,000 jobs created. Unemployment dipped to 3.5%. And I bring all of that up because these numbers come out less than 24 hours, maybe less than 12 hours after Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona made it known that thanks to some tinkering and some changes, she's down with the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, which means that it'll pass the Senate. Talk about the what changed that made it possible for her to say, yes, I'll vote for it? And then when might we actually see a vote by the Senate?
Yeah, so these job numbers, I think, just really underline for Democrats a good week they've had. This bipartisan deal, jobs numbers were higher than even the White House expected. And then, of course, this surprise Kansas abortion vote that I'm sure we'll talk about. And so Democrats are breathing a sigh of relief because they've had a lot of bad news in the past few months. And Senator Kyrsten Sinema coming on board with Democrats' plan to address climate change and reduce healthcare costs for quite a bit of Americans is another huge reason they can breathe a sigh of relief. What they did have to do, though, according to reporting from our colleagues, is make concessions on taxing the wealthy investors that can get taxed lower than their federal income through a carried interest tax loophole, for example, or the corporate minimum tax rate that President Biden had been touting all week, saying this is going to raise taxes on corporations, where Republicans countered that cost is going to get passed on to consumers, so to raise taxes on all of us. They had to cut that as well, according to initial reporting from our colleagues. They're going to try to make that up other ways. And this is all because Senator Kyrsten Sinema, while she's expressed a lot of support for addressing climate change, has been the most skeptical person in the Senate Democratic caucus about taxing corporations and the wealthy. She doesn't see that as a way forward economically.
All right, let's talk about Kansas and what happened in Kansas. You reported on the Kansas ballot initiative that would have amended the state's constitution to ban abortion. The measure lost by a stunning 19 percentage points. Stunning because Kansas is a conservative state that Donald Trump won by 15 points in the 2020 election. Did anyone see that result coming?
No, this is as surprising as it sounds, as you just laid out, Jonathan. Abortion rights supporters in Kansas were saying, if we get close before this vote, if we even get close to trying to keep Kansas a state that protects abortion rights, that will be a victory for us. Well, it wasn't close. It was a blowout for their side. And I just love some of the images of these watch parties where you can just see the surprise in these supporters' eyes. It is also surprising, as political analysts have had time to dig deeper into the numbers, that this amendment, which would have led to banning, essentially, it would have led to banning abortion, although proponents of it tried not to frame it that way, wasn't popular in conservative areas of Kansas as well. In fact, there's some data that suggests that all Kansas congressional districts, including ones that voted by 70% for Trump in 2020, opposed changing the Constitution in Kansas to allow for an abortion ban. That's significant. It suggests what Democrats are saying could be true, which is that Republicans who want to ban abortion are way out there on the extreme ends of this abortion debate. I've looked at polling that also suggests that is the case.
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up because, I mean, this wasn't a, you know, Democratic issue or a Republican issue or a Democrat running against a Republican. This was a social policy issue. And I was wondering how Democrats are viewing that Kansas vote. Are they sort of hopeful that what happened in Kansas will translate nationwide as folks go to the polls in November for the midterm elections and inure to the benefit of Democratic pro-reproductive rights candidates?
Yeah, of course they are. You heard President Biden say this week, Republicans, I'm paraphrasing, but Republicans don't know the power of women, they just found out. And so that is, that outlined clearly Democrats, I would say their path to trying to keep their majorities in Congress or not lose too many seats in the House specifically, which is to get suburban women excited about voting for Democrats. But as you point out, Jonathan, this Kansas abortion vote was an instance where abortion rights supporters had their backs against the wall. It was black or white, one or the other. There wasn't a candidate involved. Even the partisan politics of it were a little bit murky. That's very different than, say, in Michigan, a governor's race. Governor Gretchen Whitmer is trying to hold on, a Democrat there. And she, I think she feels like to win and keep her seat in a year where a lot of trends are pointing toward Republican momentum, she needs to frame her election as if abortion rights supporters are backs against, have their backs against the wall in Michigan as well. And she's trying to do that. She's saying, listen, if I lose, there's nothing standing between the Republican legislature and a Republican governor from banning abortion in Michigan, for example. That might be a harder case for Senate candidates like in Nevada and Arizona and Georgia, who are trying to either hang on or win an election in that state, because there's so much other politics involved. And Republicans are really hoping to inject the conversation around inflation. Costs are still high, potentially a recession, not good news for the party in power, and hope to tamp down some of that enthusiasm for Democrats.
Well, then let's talk about Arizona. Big night in Arizona for candidates who falsely believe the 2020 presidential election was stolen from Donald Trump. Carrie Lake won the gubernatorial nomination. Blake Masters won the GOP Senate nomination. Amber, what does that tell us about Trump's influence among Republican primary voters?
It says that at the very least, the I would say that the price of admission in Republican politics is you have to deny the 2020 election results. It wasn't just U.S. Senate and, as we learned last night, governor in Arizona, where these very vocal election deniers won their primaries. It was Secretary of State in Arizona and Attorney General. In fact, the top four positions statewide on the Republican side went to election deniers in that state. This is a state that Biden won, actually, in 2020. And so Democrats are really hoping that gives them a chance to hang on or win some of these seats, in a potentially tough environment for them. But even as we see evidence, as my colleagues had reported this week, that some Trump voters, some GOP primary voters are kind of souring on the former president. They're sick of his drama, they say. They say they feel like, let's not focus on the 2020 election. They're still rewarding his rhetoric and his attempt to remake the Republican Party with votes. And nowhere is that clearer than in Arizona.
And real quickly, we've got less than 2 minutes left, but let's talk about Arizona. State Attorney General Eric Schmidt won the nomination for Senate over the disgraced former governor Eric Greitens. How big a boost is that to Republicans in their hopes of winning back the Senate? All they need to do is get a net gain of one seat and they've got the majority.
Yeah, this was actually in Missouri. And I would say that it's not that big of a boost to Republicans. It just helped them avoid disaster. They're worried about a lot of candidates that could be troublesome. Blake Masters in Arizona denies the election, might be too far right for the a broader electorate. You can make that argument for Republican candidates in Georgia, in Pennsylvania, in Wisconsin, for example. And so Republicans feel like if they can convince voters their candidates aren't too extreme, they can take back the Senate. As you said, they just need to net one vote. But they're worried that they have so many candidates that are troublesome. And Missouri was just going to be an added worry to them. Now it's not. That was a must-win state for them anyway, just to kind of keep the status quo of 50-50.
Amber Phillips, Washington Post politics reporter, as always, thank you for coming to First Look. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
I'm going to keep the conversation going with the Opinions Roundtable in just a moment. Let's go to the opinion side of the Washington Post, where we will find Washington Post Deputy Editorial Page Editor Ruth Marcus and Washington Post columnist George Will. Ruth, George, thank you very much for coming to First Look. Okay, first things first, can we just real quickly talk about the July jobs report? 528,000 jobs created. Unemployment dips down to 3.5%. Does this mean we're really heading to a recession? Ruth, I'll start with you.
Well, it's actually quite confusing. It is obviously terrific news for all of the people whose jobs were created. It is obviously terrific news for all of the people who were not laid off and that incredibly low unemployment rate. It is complicated news for people like Fed Chair Jerome Powell, who is trying to cool the economy, but this is not an economy that looks like it's cooling. It's an economy that looks like it's revving up. And so people who are focused on inflation are gonna look at those numbers and I think have a little bit of pause, even though they are numbers to celebrate.
George?
Yes, we seem to be on the cusp of a full employment recession, which is an interesting and nice phenomenon. One asterisk over the employment figures. The employment figures do not count those people who are unemployed by choice, who have chosen to drop out of the job market. That is, workforce participation is still alarmingly low, particularly among males of prime work age, basically mid-20s to mid-50s. So there's a small asterisk over that, but still, we're in terra incognita. And Ruth talks about Jerome Powell fighting inflation. When you have an inflation somewhere between 7 and 9%, and all the Fed does is raise interest rates to 2%, that's really not yet effectively fighting inflation. At some point, interest rates have to exceed the rate of inflation.
And
landing ahead, that Jerome Powell is looking for.
Say that again, Ruth.
I said that would be not the soft landing that Jerome Powell would be looking for. That would be a really strap yourself into the seat pretty tight landing.
There is no precedent for the Federal Reserve orchestrating a soft landing from inflation as high as it is today. It just isn't. It hasn't happened before. Maybe he'll do it again. But since he's the architect of our problem, I've got limited enthusiasm for his approach to solving our problem.
I love that super dry George Will wit. Okay, so we talked about the economy. So I want to talk about the Inflation Reduction Act, because we saw a puff of white smoke coming from Senator Kyrsten Sinema late yesterday, saying she's ready to vote for it with some concessions from Senate leadership to get her vote. Ruth, how significant is this? And should it be considered a win for President Biden and for the Democrats, even though it's not the Build Back Better bill that the president was hoping to get a year ago?
Well, I'm going to leave to my friend George the title of the bill because I don't want to take away his thunder on that, whether or not it's going to reduce inflation. Yes, it is a win for President Biden. I think it's a win for the country. It's a win for the climate. It's a win for people who need help with their health insurance premiums and would have had that taken away. It is good that Senator Sinema finally sent up her puff of smoke, as you say, and agreed to do this. It is really regrettable, and I could come up with a stronger adjective for a little later in the morning. Really regrettable that she insisted on these tax changes, because the carried interest loophole is something that only benefits the rich, and keeping it only benefits the rich, and I do not understand how this serves her constituents.
George, before you jump in here, and just tell me whether this political assessment is right or wrong, but it was long known that Senator Sinema was not interested in, did not support the closing of the carried interest loophole, and the fact that Manchin and Leader Schumer put it into the bill in the first place could be seen as a gimme to Senator Sinema. We'll put it in there, it gives her something to take out and change, and we still get to pass the bill. That's what happened.
Yes, of course this counts as a win. Now, whether or not it will be a politically resonant win, I doubt. I don't think across the country in the coffee shops and beaches of America, people are agonizing over the carried interest loophole. It's a win. It's a much smaller win than he wanted. Progressives will be unhappy about this. But what he wanted was some sense that he's not floundering and that his administration has some kind of momentum. And I think he got it from this.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's keep talking about President Biden and shift our attention to Kansas and the stunning defeat of a constitutional ballot initiative that would have made it possible to ban abortions in Kansas. Here's what President Biden said the day after that vote. Let's listen.
With a record turnout, voters of Kansas defeated a ballot initiative to remove the right to choose an abortion from the Kansas Constitution. It's in the Kansas Constitution. They're trying to strike it and eliminate it from the Kansas Constitution. In a decisive vote, and a decisive victory, voters made it clear that politicians should not interfere with the fundamental rights of women. And the voters of Kansas sent a powerful signal that this fall, the American people will vote to preserve and protect the right and refuse to let them be ripped away by politicians.
Ruth, your reaction to the president's comments, but also your reaction to what can only be described as a stunning, stunning result out of Kansas.
We did a lot of advanced planning for what we would write after Tuesday night, and I have to admit that our advanced planning did not include a win in Kansas. It was stunning is the right word, the one that you used. It's from my point of view, as a supporter of abortion rights, remarkably good news. It's remarkably good news in the short term for Democrats as they look at what seems to be shaping up as a very difficult election for them, and with the inflation headwinds that we've been talking about, as a way of finally proving what they've talked about for a long time but have never really shown, which is abortion as a motivating factor to get women and other Democratic supporters to the polls and maybe peel off some of those all-important suburban women, independents, maybe even some Republicans, as we saw in Kansas. In the longer term, both now and in the future, since the Supreme Court has, for better or worse in my view, turned abortion into, at least for now, a state-by-state issue, it suggests that there is some hope in even ruby red states like Kansas for abortion rights supporters to prevail. I would add one note of a slight caution or maybe even doom in light of that, which is I had spent the previous week writing about the abortion rights debate in Indiana, where the debate before the Indiana legislature is between a bill that completely prohibits abortion except for the life of the mother and a bill that completely prohibits abortion except for the life of the mother and rape and incest. And so if that is the way a lot of state legislative debates are going to go, we're not going to have a lot of great nights like we did in Kansas.
And George, I would love to get your reaction, but also I'm wondering if the Kansas results are specific to Kansas, or do they really hold national implications for November?
I think the turnout increase, particularly among suburban women, is national in significance. But what Kansas did is the first step of a two-step process. Now they have to decide what, in fact, the law is going to be. And I think when the dust settles in many states, in most states, the United States abortion regime is going to look an awful lot like Europe's. That is, they're going to reject the extremists on the right to life side, which say no exceptions, no abortion, even for rape and incest. On the other hand, they will also, I think, in most places, reject the extremist view, which is that abortion should be available through all 9 months of the gestation of a human fetus. That bothers people. So what you're going to get is something like, dare I say it, the Mississippi law, which is restrictions up to 15 to 20 weeks. That's sort of European norm, which is about 95% of all the abortions that take place in the United States. So both extremes are going to lose, and we're going to wind up with a rather temperate reflection of what I think is clearly American public opinion, probably reflecting 60 to 70% of Americans, which is something like a cutoff after, say, 20 weeks.
Go ahead,
Ruth. Can I raise my hand? I would like to take that bet with George, and I would very much like to lose that bet. But I think that is not the prognosis that I see. If we had a national rule that allowed abortion along the lines of most European countries up to, you know, actually with a lot of other support, but say up to 15 weeks of pregnancy with understandable exceptions after that, I personally could live with that. But that is not what we are going to see in multiple states, probably half the states. We are going to see extreme bans. And by extreme, I mean absolutely no abortion except to save the life of the mother, absolutely no abortion except for cases of rape, and including rape and incest, perhaps abortion up to 6 weeks of pregnancy. If you look at Indiana, if you look at West Virginia, if you look at the trigger laws that have gone into effect, they do not reflect that European landscape that George is talking about. So George, I don't know when it is you're going to need to buy me lunch, but it might be in a year, it might be in 2 years, and I'm going to not eat it with gusto.
Well, if I get to buy your lunch, I win the bet then, because having lunch with Ruth is good fun. But remember, a lot of these trigger laws were passed by state legislators in what they thought was the sure and certain knowledge that nothing was going to come to pass, that they could try to placate rhetorically and with gestures the more extreme position on opposing abortion. Then the Supreme Court rounded on them and gave them what they said they wanted. And now they have to live with the consequences. And I think David Von Driel of The Post has written about this twice now, and I think he's absolutely right, that now that the consequences are real and the rhetoric is coming home to roost, as it were, I think most Americans, a large number, majority of Americans, are going to live under, as I say, a European abortion regime.
All right, I'll see you in Georgetown.
I'm gonna horn in on that lunch if it happens. I wanted to get to the incredible ad that former Vice President Dick Cheney did for his daughter, Congresswoman Liz Cheney, in her really tough battle for re-election. But we've got less than 5 minutes left, and we have to talk about two sports greats that passed away this week. Bill Russell the Boston Celtics great, and Vin Scully, the famed voice of the Dodgers for 67 years. George, there is no bigger baseball fan on the planet than you. So can you real quickly talk about Vin Scully's contributions to the game?
Well, baseball is in a way made for radio because it's a game of episodes, strike one, ball one, first inning, second inning, and there's a lot of moments for silence or talk or painting word pictures. Much has been made about Scully's eloquence and the wonderful voice, which I think like FDR's and Ronald Reagan's and maybe the three most recognizable voices of the 20th century in America. He was also understood the eloquence of silence. As luck would have it, the Dodgers were playing the Braves when Henry Aaron hit the home run that put him past Babe Ruth on the all-time home run list. And Scully broadcast the ball leaving the ballpark and then fell silent for, I think, 3 minutes, letting the crowd noise and the event itself marinate people. It was a great moment. I remember one night he was in the pregame run-up. He was giving information about who's hurt and who's not and who's playing. And they're playing the Cubs, the Dodgers were. And he says, and the Cubs' Andre Dawson is listed as day-to-day. But aren't we all, said Scully. Kind of drollery that you had to listen for because you knew it was coming.
And Ruth, Bill Russell, excuse me, the Boston Celtics great. He was awarded the Medal of Freedom in 2011 by President Obama, not just for his basketball greatness, but also for his activism in civil rights from boycotting a game in Kentucky in 1961 because two black teammates were refused service, to marching with Dr. King. In the little bit of time that we have left, talk more about the importance of Bill Russell.
Well, I am the last person probably at the Washington Post who should be talking about basketball, so I won't do that, but I will speak to what I've read of his incredible performance on civil rights, not just marching, not just arguing, but enduring unbelievable treatment at the hands of opposing teammates, fans, Boston Celtics. His house was ransacked, racial epithets were written, and somebody defecated in his bed. That kind of racial animus that he dealt with grace and resilience and just keeping on showing his basketball greatness was really remarkable. And this one of the stories that I like the most has to do with his unwillingness to sign autographs. And he would tell people that he wouldn't sign their autograph, that he not that he wouldn't, but that he chose not to. And then he would say, but would you like to shake my hand? What a magnificent sentence. Would you like to shake my hand? That seems to me to be the essence of Bill Russell, a man who was willing to shake hands with people across the spectrum and to keep on going despite the obstacles that he faced, and who left America a much, much better place than he found it.
Hear, hear on that score. And also, I'm just hearing that we actually do have a little bit more time left than I thought. Real quickly, Ruth and George, I do want to get your reaction to former Vice President Dick Cheney putting an ad out to in support of his daughter in her very tough August 16th Wyoming primary for her congressional seat. Will it work, Ruth? Real fast.
I'm here in Wyoming, even in bluish Jackson Hole, emphasis on the ish. There are a lot of Cheney signs. The Cheneys live here, but there are a lot of signs for her opponent. And it was a powerful, powerful ad. It's going to take a lot of Cheney magic still to get her across the finish line in that primary.
You agree, George?
I do. The word is magic, and in the real world, it doesn't work.
On that note, George Will, Ruth Marcus, as always, thank you very much for coming to First Look. Have a good weekend.
You too.
You too. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. To always stay up to date with the series, subscribe to Washington Post First Look on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. and you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.